I also knew that whatever Congress decided, President Bush was not going to back down. The time had already been set for the air war to begin, January 17th at 3 a.m. Riyadh time. Striking in the dead of night gave our fighter bombers enough time to get in and out of Iraq in near total darkness. The hour was also selected to minimize collateral damage, since most Iraqis would be at home, not on the street or at their jobs. As the day approached, I got an anxious call from my British counterpart, Sir David Craig. Colon, do you still intend to bomb Iraq's biological installations? I said that we did. Bit risky, that, eh? Craig's concern was not baseless. 2 days before, I had given the president our best military judgment. There was a risk in hitting these plants. The bombing would probably destroy any disease agents present, but it might also release them. It was a gamble, but one we had to take. I told Sir David, if it heads south, just blame me. President Bush had a knack for putting people at ease when they entered the Oval Office. A big grin and, hi, Dick, hi, Colin. Did you hear the one about the psychiatrist who? There was no smile when we met on January 15th, the day the UN deadline ran out. I'm going to have to send General Schwarzkopf an execute order, I said, if we are going to set this thing in motion. According to the joint congressional resolution passed 3 days earlier, the president was supposed to satisfy Congress that he had exhausted all efforts to get Iraq to comply with 12 UN resolutions before he could go to war. I read what I had written. The Secretary of Defense has directed that offensive operations begin on 17 January 1991. This direction assumes Iraqi failure to comply with relevant UN resolutions and that the President will make the determination required by Section 2B, House Joint Resolution 77. When I finished, no one said anything. After Dick signs it, I said, I'll send the order to Norm later this afternoon. This handful of words would unleash a war. On the evening of January 16th, the pre-battle calm descended over me. I was sitting in my office, watching CNN. Once the dice have left your hands, there is nothing to do but watch how they come up. At 6:35 p.m., I was watching CNN's Bernard Shaw, Peter Arnett, and John Holloman, like current-day Edward R. Murrows, broadcasting from the ninth floor of the Rashid Hotel, speculating over the meaning of sudden streaks of tracers exploding across the black empty sky above Baghdad. I knew the answer. It was January 17th in the Persian Gulf. The air phase of what Saddam Hussein had called the mother of all battles had begun. I was up most of the night watching television out of the corner of my eye as we conducted our first war while it was being broadcast live from the enemy capital. Just after 5 a.m. Washington time, Schwarzkopf called again with his first summary report of the air campaign. Norm was too much the professional to be carried away by the first blush of victory, but he was hard-pressed to conceal his excitement. We got off 850 missions, he said. We clobbered most of the targets. Iraq's key biological weapons and nuclear sites had been hit hard. The Iraqis' western air defense system was knocked out. Supply dumps were in flames. The euphoria of the first day actually created a problem. Reports by CNN's Wolf Blitzer from the Pentagon made it seem as if all that remained to do was to organize the victory parade. I called Pete Williams, the Defense Department spokesman. Pete, tell Blitzer and these other guys to cool it. This is the beginning of a war, not the end of a ballgame. In this age of instant information, people tended to expect instant results. Over the next few days, the mood shifted quickly from euphoria to a funk. Why hadn't we won yet? On the morning of the 22nd, I went upstairs to see Secretary Cheney. Dick, we've got to put this thing into perspective. So far, no senior administration official had explained how the war was going. Somebody should be doing that, I said. We'll hold a press conference tomorrow, Dick decided. I then called my chart makers and had them put together graphics. Along with a detailed briefing on the operation, I also wanted a soundbite that would capture the essence of this campaign. My presentation was deliberately understated and unemotional as I explained the battle plan. And then I delivered the punchline. Our strategy in going after this army is very simple, I said. First we are going to cut it off, and then we are going to kill it. Those words led the press coverage on television that evening. They achieved what I wanted. They let the world, and particularly Iraq, know our war aim unmistakably. History is scarred with disasters arising from misjudgments of resolution and misreadings of intent. The Scud was a cheap, crude, inaccurate Soviet engine of destruction. It was the only offensive air weapon the Iraqis used. The Scud missile could only carry a 160-pound warhead. If these Scuds struck within 2 miles of a target, it was considered a hit. However, cities present targets that size, and when Scuds began to fall on Tel Aviv and Haifa, the Israelis instinctively wanted to lash back. Yet if we were going to preserve the Arab end of the coalition, we had to keep the Israelis out of this fight, and there was only one way: stop the Scuds. Norm Schwarzkopf began diverting more and more of his combat aircraft to Scud busting, as many as a third of all missions flown. British and U.S. Special Operations troops slipped behind enemy lines to search out Scuds. American Patriot missile units were sent to help protect major Israeli cities. Scuds still came through, but less often. Prime Minister Shamir showed a special brand of statesmanship in resisting heavy pressure from those around him to strike back. The forbearance of the Israelis, in the face of intense provocation, helped keep the coalition intact. By the third week in February, the air war had been going on uninterrupted for 35 days. Norm had informed us that his ground troops would be ready to move on the 24th, but the offensive timetable was clouded as Mikhail Gorbachev tried to play peacemaker. President Bush was in a bind. Bush wanted to deliver a knockout punch to the Iraqi invaders in Kuwait. He did not want to win by a TKO that would allow Saddam to withdraw with his army intact, intact and waiting for another day. Nevertheless, the president could not be seen as turning his back on a chance for peace. I pointed out that world opinion had supported the UN's January 15th deadline for Saddam to clear out of Kuwait. So let's put a deadline on Gorby's proposal. We say, great idea. As long as they're completely on their way out, by, say, noon Saturday. The next morning, President Bush stood before the cameras in the Rose Garden and made the announcement. At noon on Saturday, February 23rd, Saddam let the Russian withdrawal proposal go by. At 4 a.m., Riyadh time the following day, in darkness and cold rain, the ground war began. Too keyed up to sleep, I stayed in the office. The Marines, rather than merely pinning down the Iraqis, had broken through the enemy defenses and were already moving toward Kuwait City. In the west, Major General Barry McCaffrey's 24th Infantry Division punched 60 miles into Iraqi territory on the first day. In those 24 hours of land combat, 10,000 hungry, thirsty, exhausted Iraqi soldiers, stunned by 38 days of air bombardment, surrendered. Our total casualties the first day were 8 dead, 27 wounded. Before the ground war began, someone on my staff had given me a book entitled Every War Must End by Fred E. Clay. Warfare is such an all-absorbing enterprise, E. Clay wrote, that after starting one, a government may lose sight of ending it. As an example, E. Clay mentioned the cunningly conceived attack on Pearl Harbor as contrasted to the scant thought the Japanese had given to how the war they started would end. I was so impressed by E. Clay's ideas that I had key passages photocopied and circulated to the Joint Chiefs, Cheney, and Scowcroft. We were fighting a limited war under a limited mandate for a limited purpose, which was soon going to be achieved. On February 27th, I spoke to Norm Schwarzkopf and told him I sensed we were nearing endgame. The prisoner catch was 70,000. Saddam had ordered his forces to withdraw from Kuwait. The last major escape route, a four-lane highway leading out of Kuwait City toward the Iraqi city of Basra, had turned into a shooting gallery for our flyers. Reporters began referring to this road as the Highway of Death. I would have to give the President and the Secretary a recommendation soon as to when to stop. I've been thinking the same thing, Norm said. One more day should do it. At about 2 p.m., I entered the Oval Office. When I finished describing the military chessboard, I said, "We don't want to be seen as killing for the sake of killing, Mr. President. I've talked to General Schwarzkopf. I expect by sometime tomorrow the job will be done, and I'll probably be bringing you a recommendation to stop the fighting." "If that's the case," the President said, "why not end it today?" "That's something to consider, but I need to talk to Norm first." I left and found a secure phone, and the White House military operator put me through to Riyadh. "Norm," I said, President wants to know if we can end it now. When is now? He asked. We're looking at this evening. I don't have any problem, Norm said. Our objective was to drive him out, and we've done it. But let me talk to my field commanders, and unless they've run into a snag I don't know about, I don't see why we shouldn't stop. I reported this back to the president and the rest of his advisors. We all concurred in the president's tentative decision to stop the war. Several hours later, we met again in the Oval Office to confirm the decision. I told the president I would like to give Norm a few more hours of daylight so that he could check the battlefield and clean up any loose ends. This prompted an inspiration from John Sununu. Why not make it effective midnight our time? That'll make it the 100-hour war, the chief of staff said. The president agreed, and I got on the phone and passed the word to Schwarzkopf. The president and then Cheney came on the line to congratulate the sink. Hell of a job, Norm, the president said. At 9:02 p.m., the president spoke to the nation. Kuwait is liberated. Iraq's army is defeated. Our military objectives are met, he began. I am pleased to announce that at midnight tonight, Eastern Standard Time, exactly 100 hours since ground operations commenced, and 6 weeks since the start of Operation Desert Storm, all U.S. and coalition forces will suspend offensive combat operations. Over 130 years after the event, historians are still debating General George Meade's decision not to pursue General Robert E. Lee's forces after the Union victory at Gettysburg. A half century after World War II, scholars are still arguing over General Eisenhower's decision not to beat the Soviet armies to Berlin. And I expect years from now, historians will still ask if we should not have fought longer and destroyed more of the Iraqi army. Critics will still argue that we should have widened our war aims to include seizing Baghdad and driving Saddam Hussein from power, as we had done with Noriega and the Panama Defense Force in Panama. Matters were not helped when, 1 month after the war's end, Norm Schwarzkopf appeared on a PBS program talking with David Frost. Regarding the decision to end the fighting, Norm first said, I reported that situation to General Powell, and he and I discussed have we accomplished our military objectives, the campaign objectives, and the answer is yes. But a moment later, Norm said, frankly, my recommendation had been, you know, continue the march. I mean, we had them in a rout, and we could have continued, you know, to reap great destruction upon them. That morning, the direct White House line in my console rang with that insistent shrillness that made me sit at attention. George Bush sounded more hurt than angered. What did Norm mean? He had certainly been consulted about stopping the fighting. The war would not have ended then if he had asked for more time. I talked to Norm myself, the president said. I shared the president's disappointment. In fact, I was mad at hell at what Schwarzkopf had told David Frost. I called Norman Riad. That story won't fly, I said. You're saying the president made a mistake. You made it look as if you gave him a different recommendation and he ignored it. That's not what I meant at all, Norm replied. That's what came across, I said, and the media are beating up on him. Norm Schwarzkopf was deservedly a national hero, and the criticism that the fighting had stopped too soon had chipped his pedestal. He did not like it. The president, ever loyal, learned that Norm was feeling abused and called him, telling him not to worry. Still, I felt it was important to keep the record straight. I put out a public statement after clearing it with Norm that read, General Schwarzkopf and I both supported terminating Desert Storm combat operations at midnight, 27 February 1991, Eastern Standard Time, as did all the president's advisers. There was no contrary recommendation. There was no disagreement. There was no debate. Norm began to back off from his Frost pronouncement, and in his book, It Doesn't Take a Hero, he explained his thinking. My gut reaction was that a quick ceasefire would save lives. If we continued to attack through Thursday, more of our troops would get killed, probably not many, but some. What was more, we'd accomplished our mission. I'd just finished telling the American people that there wasn't enough left of Iraq's army for it to be a regional military threat. We'd kick this guy's butt, leaving no doubt in anybody's mind that we'd won decisively, and we'd done it with very few casualties. Why not end it? Why get somebody else killed tomorrow? That made up my mind. Schwarzkopf was absolutely right, yet it is still hard to drive a stake through charges that the job was left unfinished. The truth is that the remaining Iraqi army is hardly a force with a will to fight to the death. In October 1994, Saddam Hussein sent 20,000 Republican guards toward the Kuwaiti border, a paltry attempt to look tough while trying to get relief from UN sanctions. Immediately, the cry went up from the simple solutionist. If only Saddam had been polished off during the Gulf War, he would not be stirring up trouble now. On October 23rd, the New York Times printed on its front page a long excerpt from a book on the Gulf War co-authored by one of the paper's reporters. The book excerpt was headlined, How Iraq Escaped the Threatened Kuwait Again. In it, the authors stated that much of Iraq's crack troops, the Republican Guard, had not been destroyed, and that was why Saddam could still wield threatening military power. While the belief that Saddam pulled off some sort of Dunkirk at the end of Desert Storm may have a superficial attraction, I want to cut it off and kill it once and for all. It is true that more tanks and Republican Guard troops escaped from Kuwait than we expected. And yes, we could have taken another day or two to close that escape hatch. But it would not have made a bit of difference in Saddam's future conduct. Iraq, a nation of 20 million people, can always pose a threat to its tiny neighbor Kuwait with only 750,000 people. With or without Saddam, and with or without the Republican Guard, Kuwait's security depends on arrangements with its friends in the region and with the United States. That is the strategic reality. But why didn't we push on to Baghdad once we had Saddam on the run? Why didn't we finish him off? What tends to be forgotten is that while the United States led the way, we were heading an international coalition carrying out a clearly defined UN mandate. The president had promised the American people that Desert Storm would be no Middle Eastern Vietnam, and he kept his promise. Not only did Desert Storm accomplish its political objective, it started to reverse the climate of chronic hostility in the Middle East. King Hussein of Jordan and Yasser Arafat, chairman of the PLO, were the only two Arab leaders who showed some support for Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War, and both were weakened by their stance. As a result, 3 years later, they were trying to reach accommodations with Israel and their other neighbors. Many correspondents covering the war and their media bosses back home complained that they were over-controlled by the military. They were confined to press pools. They could not roam around the battlefield without military escorts. The image of World War II's legendary Ernie Pyle filing stories from European foxholes and Pacific beachheads was thrown in our faces by our critics. For the record, Ernie Pyle and his fellow World War II reporters were strictly censored. In the Gulf War, stories were reviewed by the military for security purposes. Of all the stories submitted by press pool reporters, one was changed to protect intelligence procedures. In Desert Storm, we tried to maintain military security while handling the largest concentration of correspondents ever gathered for a military operation. The troops came home to a wildly cheering America. I took part in victory parades in Chicago and Washington, and in a ticker tape parade up Broadway in New York, where Alma and I rode in a white 1959 Buick convertible. Ahead of us were Cheney and his wife Lynn, and behind us Norm Schwarzkopf and his wife Brenda. It was an emotional moment to be at the center of an event I had only seen in history books and newsreels, celebrating a Lindbergh or an Eisenhower or a MacArthur. Norm, a New Jerseyite, and I, a New Yorker, riding through a blizzard of tape, confetti, and balloons, while thousands cheered their heads off, were two hometown boys who had made good. We were surrogates for the real heroes, the troops who had given back to Americans pride in their country. The celebrations were no doubt out of proportion to the achievement. We had not fought another World War II. Yet, after the stalemate of Korea and the long agony in Southeast Asia, the country was hungry for victory. We had given America a clear win with few casualties in a noble cause, and the American people fell in love again with their armed forces. The way I looked at it, if we got too much adulation for this one, it made up for the neglect the troops had experienced coming home from those other wars. That spring I was invited to throw out the first ball at Yankee Stadium in the season opener between the Yankees and the Chicago White Sox. The next day I walked up the worn stone steps of Morris High School. I looked over a sea of mostly Hispanic and black faces, and I recalled what it had been like to be here as a boy 37 years before. I remember this place, I told them. I remember the feeling that you can't make it, but you can. When I was coming up, the opportunities were limited, but now they are there. You can be anything you want to be. But wanting to be isn't enough. Dreaming about it isn't enough. You got to study for it, work for it, fight for it with all your heart and soul. Choose a role model, and feel free to choose a black or a white, a general or a teacher, or just the parents who brought you into the world. I do not know if I reached a single youngster that day, but I was determined to leave Morris High with a message for those kids. Reject the easy path of victimhood. Dare to take the harder path of work and commitment, a path that leads somewhere. I had urged the kids to pick their role models from any race, because I am concerned that the ideal of black pride can be carried to an extreme where it produces isolation. We have to accept that black children in America are not going to have to make their way in an African world. They are going to have to make their way in an American world. On the white majority college campuses, in our inner cities, in almost every area of social interaction, we see an unhealthy resegregation occurring, sometimes self-imposed, sometimes imposed by economics. When disillusioned blacks go off by themselves, they withdraw from the promise of America. They then allow whites to walk away too, saying, if that's what they want, so be it. I have lived in and risen in a white-dominated society. My blackness has been a source of pride, strength, and inspiration, and so has my being an American. I started out believing in an America where anyone given equal opportunity can succeed through hard work and faith. I still believe in that America. On the morning of May 2nd, I went to the kitchen, poured my coffee, and glanced at the Washington Post. I was front page news. Bob Woodward's book, The Commanders, was coming out in a few days, and the Post had a story based on it. I had no quarrel with the total picture of me that Woodward presented, but the emphasis in the media barrage that followed was on the few pages of the book implying that I had privately opposed the president on the Gulf War, a publicity strategy designed to propel Woodward's work into bestsellerdom through the booster rocket of controversy. That same morning, a White House operator called to say that President Bush was coming on the line. I waited uneasily. Colin, pay no attention to that nonsense. Don't worry about it. Don't let him get under your skin. Thanks, Mr. President. Barb says hello. See ya. Click. Later that day, reporters hit the president with more questions about me, as depicted in Woodward's book. Nobody's going to drive a wedge between Powell and me, he said. I don't care what kind of book they've got, how many unnamed sources they have, how many quotes they put in the mouth of somebody when they weren't there. I will never forget this loyalty from the President of the United States at a time when I needed a friend. I had just fallen asleep at about 20 minutes after midnight on August 19th when I got a call from the duty officer in the National Military Command Center. A coup against the Gorbachev government was underway. President Bush was in his summer place in Kennebunkport, Maine, but came back immediately to Washington and assumed a stance of watchful waiting. What do you make of this business, Colin? The president asked. Did you notice how the tanks came into Moscow? I said. They were rolling down the middle of the road, headed nowhere in particular. People were waving, handing the tankers flowers, chatting with them. I pointed out that no tanks had sealed off the Kremlin or the Russian parliament. No forces had taken over the central telephone exchange, standard operating procedure during coups. What all this tells me, Mr. President, is that the plotters don't own the army. The military is not backing this coup. Within 3 days, the coup collapsed, and Gorbachev was restored to power. The failed attempt marked the end of Soviet communism, the beginning of the end for Gorbachev, and the making of Boris Yeltsin. On the same day that I was reconfirmed as chairman, Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the first democratically elected president in Haiti's history, had been overthrown by a military junta. With Aristide's downfall, Haitians began boarding anything that would float in their eagerness to get to the United States. On October 29th, President Bush banned all U.S. commercial trade with Haiti to punish the military dictatorship, which also made Haitians even more desirous than ever to get out. The U.S. military drew the unwelcome assignment of detaining fleeing Haitians at Guantanamo Bay until it could be determined if they were legitimate political refugees entitled to come to the United States. By December, the Pentagon was being asked about military options to put Aristide back into power. My advice to Cheney was to go slow. We can take the place in an afternoon with a company or two of Marines, I said, but the problem is getting out. We had intervened in Haiti in 1915 for reasons that sounded identical to what I was hearing now. to end terror, restore stability, promote democracy, and protect U.S. interests, and that occupation had lasted 19 years. Christmas Day, 1991, the unimaginable happened. The Soviet Union disappeared, without a fight, without a war, without a revolution. It vanished, as leaders of the former Soviet republics met in the remote Kazakhstan capital of Alma-Ata and dissolved the world's only other superpower with the stroke of a pen. Mikhail Gorbachev was out of a job. I remembered what he had said to me on that day back in 1988 in the Kremlin. What are you going to do now that you've lost your best enemy? It was now more important than ever, I believed, that we get the base force, the plan for a smaller, more efficient military, accepted by Congress. By early 1992, we were deeply into reductions to bring the armed forces down by the 25% the administration had announced earlier. Despite bureaucratic resistance, our reductions went forward and began to bite. Bases closed, troops and civilians left the service. Program cuts affected the economy and would become an election issue in 1992. George Bush was not going to win re-election on memories of Desert Storm alone. His once stratospheric job approval rating in the polls was down by May 1992 to 40%. Dan Quayle was a drag on the ticket, Bush was warned, and the press kept mentioning my name among likely replacements. The speculation became so intense that by mid-May I felt I had to call Quayle. Mr. Vice President, I know how uncomfortable this talk has to be for you. All I can tell you is I'm not the source. I'm not engineering anything. I intend to stick to my job as chairman. I know, Colin, he said. It's part of the cost of doing business in this town. Vernon Jordan, a politically connected Washington lawyer and a close friend, came to see me on behalf of the camp of Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. Your polls are running off the chart, Vernon said. Are you interested in running as Clinton's VP? Vernon, I said, first of all, I don't intend to step out of uniform one day and into partisan politics the next. Second, I don't even know what I am politically. And third, George Bush picked me and stuck by me. I could never campaign against him. 10 years after the idea had first struck me, the monument to the Buffalo Soldiers had become a reality. I was on my way to Kansas to take part in the unveiling ceremony. As I worked on my speech for the dedication, I found myself thinking about General Ben Davis, who stuck it out for 4 years at West Point while his fellow cadets gave him the silent treatment because he was black. After that ordeal, Davis reported for duty to Fort Benning, where he and his wife were shunned socially by white officers. Davis, who later commanded the famous Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, once remarked, "Combat was not easy, but you could only get killed once. Living with the day-to-day degradation of racism was far more difficult. I arrived on a sweltering Kansas summer afternoon. The sky was turning dark with thunderheads, but nothing could mar the mood." A crowd of thousands engulfed the heart of the post where the monument stood. Flags snapped and bands played. The governor spoke. Finally, it was my turn. I looked out over the audience. Before me, bent over canes, sitting in wheelchairs, some still standing erect, were dozens of veteran Buffalo soldiers, men in their 90s, even in their hundreds. I looked up at the sky and said, "I know you're all watching that very dark cloud. Forget about it. It ain't going to rain on us. Not today." August marked a personal milestone. 30 years of marriage for Alma and me. Our kids arranged an anniversary celebration at home. Mike was now recovered, a family man himself, and enrolled in Georgetown Law School. Linda had made her Broadway debut, and Anne Marie had joined the world of network television as a production coordinator. When the guests were gone, Alma and I sat among the festive debris knowing we were richly blessed, and in the lottery of love and marriage, I knew that I had been the big winner. President-elect Bill Clinton was also a winner. The world had a dozen other running sores that fall, but television hovered over Somalia and wrenched our hearts with images of people starving to death before our eyes. The United Nations had planted a humanitarian relief effort there, and the United States had committed 600 troops and provided C-130 transports to fly in food. We rarely knew what happened to the relief supplies. Local warlords stole the food from warehouses. The day before Thanksgiving, President Bush called a meeting that I attended with Cheney, Scowcroft, and a handful of others. The new SYNC CENTCOM, General Joseph Hoare, who had replaced Norm Schwarzkopf when he retired, had readied a contingency mercy mission for Somalia, Operation Restore Hope, which I now laid out for the president. It involved putting a substantial number of U.S. troops on the ground to take charge of the place and to make sure the food got to the starving Somalis. "I like it," the president said. "We'll do it." Brent Scowcroft looked uneasy. "Sure, we can get in, but how do we get out?" "We'll do it and try to be out by January 19th, the president concluded. "I don't want to stick Clinton with an ongoing military operation." Cheney and I eyed each other. "Mr. President," Dick said, "we can't get in there fully until mid-December, and the job won't be done by January 19th. The mission succeeded from the start. Brent Scowcroft's initial uneasiness, nevertheless, was justified. The famine had been provoked not by the whims of nature, but by internal feuding. How were we to get out of Somalia without turning the country back to the same warlords whose rivalries had produced the famine in the first place? On December 22nd, President-elect Clinton nominated Les Aspin as his Secretary of Defense. The waning hours of the Bush era were not particularly pleasant for me. I was starting to feel like the kid about to enter a new school full of strangers. At President Clinton's first meeting with his top military advisors, Les Aspin asked me to lead off with a quick briefing on current Pentagon concerns, the status of forces, troop levels, and the defense budget. As soon as I finished, however, we spent the next 105 minutes solely on homosexuals in the armed forces. I was increasingly disappointed that this issue had become the new administration's first priority. I also thought I understood why. Bill Clinton had already backed off from other campaign stands. "Mr. President," I said at one point during the discussion, "we know gays and lesbians serve ably and honorably, but not openly. If they are allowed to do so, that's going to raise tough issues of privacy. We could stop asking about sexual orientation when people enlist. That might provide a practical compromise." The president decided to stick to the current policy, while the military was to carry out a 6-month study of the issue. In the meantime, enlistees were not to be asked about their sexual orientation. As contentious as the issue was, the chiefs and I left the meeting feeling optimistic. The next day, the media hit me and the chiefs with both barrels. A New York Times editorial charges us with being defiantly opposed, almost to the point of insubordination. Times columnist Abe Rosenthal said that Colin Powell would never have become chairman but for President Truman's racial integration of the military in 1948. Meanwhile, my office was receiving more than 3,000 letters and phone calls a day, never running less than 6-1 in favor of keeping the ban. My objections to removing the ban were not knee-jerk traditionalist. I did not, for example, oppose having women perform certain combat roles, such as flying fighter aircraft or serving aboard ship. And I recognize that some of those who wanted to keep the ban on gays did, in fact, spout arguments similar to those used to resist racial integration in the armed forces nearly 40 years before. Nevertheless, I continued to see a fundamental distinction. Requiring people of different color to live together in intimate situations is far different from requiring people of different sexual orientation to do so. On February 10th, the New York Times used the gay issue as the peg for an article that was headlined, "Joint Chief's Head is Said to Request Early Retirement." The Times account contained a grain of truth. I had told Aspin and Dick Cheney even earlier that I might leave a month or two before my term was up, but mostly for the convenience of my successor before the next budget cycle. 9 months later, Congress approved a new policy, now shorthanded as "Don't Ask, Don't Tell." I expect that the courts will ultimately decide the issue once and for all. Soon after the inauguration, the Clinton National Security Team gathered in the Situation Room for the first time. The issue was Bosnia. This meeting set the pattern for all that were to follow. The discussions meandered like graduate student bull sessions or think tank seminars, in which many of my new colleagues had spent the last 12 years while their party was out of power. Backbenchers sounded off with the authority of cabinet officers. Bosnia was the foreign policy issue over which candidate Clinton had criticized Bush most sharply. Clinton had promised more aggressive action in that tormented place. Now he had the opportunity, and the meetings were full of belligerent rhetoric. I laid out the same military options that I had presented to President Bush. Our choices ranged from limited airstrikes around Sarajevo to heavy bombing of the Serbs throughout the theater. My constant unwelcome message at all the meetings on Bosnia was simply that we should not commit military forces until we had a clear political objective. Aspin shared this view. The debate exploded at one session when Madeleine Albright, our ambassador to the United Nations, asked me in frustration, "What's the point of having this superb military that you're always talking about if we can't use it?" I thought I would have an aneurysm. I patiently explained that we had used our armed forces more than 24 times in the preceding 3 years for war, peacekeeping, disaster relief, and humanitarian assistance. But in every one of those cases, we had a clear goal. Tony Lake, now the National Security Advisor, had served on the NSC during the Vietnam War and supported my position. "You know, Madeleine, the kinds of questions Colin is asking about goals are exactly the ones the military never asked during Vietnam." In 1994 and in 1995, the United Nations and NATO, at U.S. prodding, did conduct limited strikes, and the Serbs employed the expected countermeasures by taking hostages and stopping the airstrikes cold. The harsh reality has been that the Serbs, Muslims, and the Croatians are committed to fight to the death for what they believe to be their vital interest. We do not have a similar vital interest, and no American president could sustain the long-term involvement necessary to stop the war and to keep the protagonists from going at each other's throats all over again at the first opportunity. That spring, I was asked to introduce the president at the Memorial Day ceremony at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Some veterans groups charged that it dishonored the 58,191 names on that wall to have a draft dodger speak at the memorial. Other vets took the position that Bill Clinton was now commander-in-chief, and he had better show up, if only to earn absolution for his conduct during the war. I believed he should speak because he was the commander-in-chief, and as a practical matter, if he did not make an appearance this year, the issue would come up next year and the next. I readily agreed to introduce him. The president seemed relaxed and in good humor as we started out. But as we neared the wall where a crowd of over 5,000 people were waiting, I could see the muscles of his face tightening. We got out of the car to scattered applause and the boos of protesters whom the park police had managed to keep on the fringe. The applause exceeded the jeering as the president made what I am sure was one of the most difficult speeches of his life, and it was a graceful effort. That summer we started to bring American troops home from Somalia, intending to leave only about 4,200 to support the UN operation. By then, the Somalis were apparently feeling sufficiently well-nourished to resume killing each other and any perceived enemies. On June 5th, a shootout between followers of a major clan leader, General Mohammed Farha Adid, and UN forces left 24 Pakistani soldiers dead. At U.S. urging, the UN passed a resolution authorizing a hunt for the perpetrators. This action was taken without any serious discussion among senior U.S. policymakers over expanding the Somali commitment from nation-building to hunting down Somali chieftains. The UN Special Envoy, the UN Commander, and the American Commander asked for U.S. helicopter gunships and AC-130 strike planes to attack Somali strongholds. I supported the request, and the President approved. But when the UN command further pressed us to send in our elite counter-terrorist Delta Force to capture Adid, I resisted, as did Secretary Aspin and Marine General Joe Hoare, now the sink of CENTCOM. I tried to get our spreading commitment reviewed, but I was unsuccessful. In the meantime, we started to take American casualties. In late August, I reluctantly yielded to the repeated requests from the field and recommended to Aspin that we dispatch the Rangers and the Delta Force. It was a recommendation I would later regret. The manhunt for General Adid went on. Major General Montgomery, the American commander in Somalia, began pleading for tanks and armored vehicles to protect his supply convoys from raids by warlords. This threat understandably confused Americans. Why, since we had gone into Somalia to feed its starving people, were our troops being shot at? This was the quicksand that the UN nation-building mission had sucked us into. With our commander on the ground pleading for help to protect American soldiers, I had to back him. With only 3 days left in my term, I was in Les Aspin's office making one last pitch to him to give Montgomery the armor he wanted. "It ain't going to happen," Aspin, the political realist, said. Many members of Congress, led by Democratic Senator Bob Byrd, were saying we had no further business in Somalia and should withdraw immediately. I had done what I had to do, a soldier backing soldiers. Aspin had done what a civilian policymaker has to do, try to meet the larger objective, in this case, to get us out of Somalia, not further into it. I was in my office at my usual hour and was surprised to get a message that President Clinton wanted to see me. My retirement ceremony was scheduled for 4 p.m., and he had graciously agreed to preside. I wondered what this meeting was about. On my arrival at the White House, I was ushered up to the second-floor residential quarters. "Let's go sit on the porch," he said, leading me out to the Truman balcony. "I don't have any agenda," the president said. "I'm just grateful for what you've done for me and the country, and I wanted us to have some time together." We talked a little politics, a subject he clearly relished, and then we discussed domestic issues with health care much on his mind. We then turned to national security. Somalia was uppermost in my thoughts at the moment. I told him that we could not substitute our version of democracy for hundreds of years of tribalism. "We can't make a country out of that place. We've got to find a way to get out, and soon," I said. I glanced at my watch. We had been talking for over an hour. "I feel guilty about taking up so much of your time," I said. "This day is for you," Bill Clinton answered, as if he did not have a care in the world. At that point, a frantic aide poked his head through the door and said, "Mr. President, it's time to go to work." The president rose. "Colin, I'll see you this afternoon." I thanked him for his thoughtfulness, not just this day, but during the entire 9 months that I had served him. In spite of early press speculation to the contrary, we had gotten along well and had become close. Just days after this conversation, the Rangers and the Delta Force ran into a stiff firefight in Somalia, and 18 of our men were killed. Americans were horrified by the sight of a dead U.S. soldier dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. We had been drawn into this place by television images. Now we were being repelled by them. The setback marked the beginning of the end for Les Aspin. In December, President Clinton announced that he would be replaced by his deputy, Bill Perry. Les Aspin went on to serve President Clinton in other positions until his life was tragically cut short by a stroke in May of 1995. After my visit to the White House, I held my final meetings and thanked the directors of the joint staff who had served me so faithfully for 4 years. And I had my last lunch with the service chiefs in the sinks. That afternoon, President Clinton presided at my retirement ceremony. The troops passed in review. A flyover of jets and helicopters roared above the parade ground. And then the commander of the old guard came and saluted me. "Sir," he said, "this concludes the ceremony." It was over. 35 years, 3 months, and 21 days. That night I took off the uniform for the last time. In the years I had worn it, I had benefited beyond my wildest hopes from all that is good in this country, and I had overcome its lingering faults. I had found something to do with my life that was honorable, useful, and that I could do well, and that I loved doing. That is rare good fortune in anyone's life. My only regret was that I could not do it all over again. I woke up the next morning without the benefit of an alarm clock for the first time in living memory. I got dressed and ambled down to the kitchen of the new home we had bought in the Washington suburbs to join Alma for breakfast, another first, at least in decades. Alma looked up from her coffee. "The sink's stopped up. It's leaking all over." I spent my first civilian morning crouched under a dripping sink. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had become Harry Homeowner. I have retired from the Army, but not from an active life. On December 15, 1993, the son of two black immigrants from a tiny British colony was knighted by the Queen of England. On May 10, 1994, as a member of the U.S. delegation, I found myself sitting in front of the Union Building on a hill over Pretoria, watching the once unimaginable happen. To the cheers of tens of thousands of people filling the hillside, four white senior officers of the South African Armed Forces formed a guard of honor to escort their country's next president, Nelson Mandela, to the stage. On Thursday, September 15, 1994, former President Jimmy Carter phoned me asking if I would join him and Senator Sam Nunn on a mission to Haiti that weekend to stave off a potentially bloody invasion. The UN had recently authorized the use of force to topple the island's military dictatorship and to return Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. The agreement we worked out was criticized. The thugs supposedly got off too easily. The criticism did not bother me. Once our troops set foot in Haiti, for better or worse, we ran the place. What happened to the junta was inconsequential. Because of what we accomplished, young Americans, and probably far more Haitians who would have died, were still alive. That was success enough for me. From the privacy of retirement, I watch a fundamental transformation in a world I knew so well for the 35 years of my career. The world I knew was defined by an historic struggle between the Soviet Union and the West, with rules that structured our political, economic, and military relations. It was a dangerous period, but relatively stable, and one in which we understood the role we had to play. With the end of the Soviet Union and the death of communism as an ideology, we face a world so far without a new structure or a new set of rules. Our strategy of containment died with the Soviet Union and communism. I am heartened by the reconciliations taking place around the globe, by a fundamental shift from chronic conflict to negotiated settlements. The IRA in Britain, the Middle East peace process, Mozambique, Angola, Cambodia, El Salvador, Nicaragua, South Africa, all offer examples of crises resolving themselves through the exhaustion of the protagonists and diplomatic intervention, often by the UN, allowing the protagonists to get off the treadmill of violence. Still, this is not going to be a world without war or conflict. Bosnia and Chechnya remind us of the force of factional nationalist passions. Fortunately, our country is not at war anywhere. We can be true to our identity as the standard-bearer of human dignity and freedom. The cause is flourishing all around the world. Individual freedom has shown its supremacy over police state conformity. I am impressed by our nation's present entrepreneurial vitality. Everything I observe affirms my belief in free enterprise. It creates new wealth, generates new jobs, enables people to live good lives, fuels demand, and triggers fresh enterprises, starting the cycle all over again. This phenomenon is not trickle-down Reaganomics. It is the way that prosperous economies work. Government should not interfere with the demonstrated success of the free marketplace, beyond controls to protect public safety and to prevent distortions of competition by either labor or industry. I am concerned, however, that the present tax burden on Americans is so high that it seriously risks dampening our entrepreneurial vitality. I believe so strongly in job-producing free enterprise because jobs are the best answer to most of our social ills. Because I express these beliefs, some people have rushed to hang a Republican label around my neck. I am not, however, knee-jerk anti-government. I was born a New Deal Depression-era kid. Government helped my parents by providing cheap public subway systems so that they could get to work, and public schools for their children, and protection under the law to make sure their labor was not exploited. Social Security allowed my parents to live a dignified retirement. Medicare gave them access to quality care during long, painful terminal illnesses. I received a free college education because New York taxed its citizens to make this investment in the sons and daughters of immigrants and the working class. The great domestic political challenge of our time is to reconcile the necessity for fiscal responsibility with the explosive growth in entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare, which the needy and the middle class rely on so heavily. Realistically, we have only two alternatives. Either we reduce the entitlement system, or we raise taxes to pay for it. We cannot keep balancing the books by increasing the deficit. However, until our leaders are willing to talk straight talk to the American people, and the people are willing to accept hard realities, no solution will be found to relieve our children and grandchildren of the crushing debt that we are currently amassing as their inheritance. While the current call for less government is justified, in one role I want government to be vigorous and active, and that is in ensuring the protections of the Constitution to all Americans. Equal rights and equal opportunity mean just that. They do not mean preferential treatment. Preferences, no matter how well-intended, ultimately breed resentment among the non-preferred. and preferential treatment demeans the achievements that minority Americans earn on their own merits. If affirmative action means programs that provide equal opportunity, then I am all for it. If it leads to preferential treatment, I am opposed. To sum up my political philosophy, I am a fiscal conservative with a social conscience. I have found my philosophy, if not my political affiliation. Neither of the two major parties fits me comfortably in their present state. I am troubled by the political passion of those on the extreme right who seem to claim divine wisdom on political as well as spiritual matters. God provides us with guidance and inspiration, not a legislative agenda. I am disturbed by the class and racial undertones beneath the surface of their rhetoric. On the other side of the spectrum, I am put off by patronizing liberals who claim to know what is best for society with little thought as to who will eventually pay the bills. I question the priorities of those liberals who lavish so much attention on individual license and entitlements that little concern is left for the good of the community at large. As I speak around the country, I am constantly questioned about my own future. Specifically, am I going to run for president? I am flattered by my standing in public opinion polls. To be a successful politician, however, requires a calling that I do not yet hear. I believe that I can serve my nation in other ways, through charities, educational work, or appointive posts. Nevertheless, I do not unequivocally rule out a political future. If I ever do decide to enter politics, however, it will not be because of high popularity ratings, but because I have a vision for this country. Frankly, the present atmosphere does not make entering public service especially attractive. I find that civility is being driven from our political discourse. For all the present sensitivity over correctness, we seem to have lost our sense of shame as a society. We say we are appalled by the rise of sexually transmitted disease, by the wave of teenage pregnancies, by violent crime. Yet, we drench ourselves in depictions of explicit sex and crime on television, in the movies, and in pop music. How do we find our way again? How do we reestablish moral standards? How do we end the ethnic fragmentation that is making us an increasingly hyphenated people? How do we restore a sense of family to our national life? On the speech circuit, I tell a story that goes to the heart of America's longing. The ABC correspondent Sam Donaldson was interviewing a young African-American soldier in a tank platoon on the eve of battle in Desert Storm. Donaldson asked, "How do you think the battle will go? Are you afraid?" "We'll do okay. We're well trained. And I'm not afraid," the GI answered, gesturing toward his buddies around him. "I'm not afraid because I'm with my family." The other soldiers shouted, "Tell him again, he didn't hear you." The soldier repeated, "This is my family, and we'll take care of each other." That story never fails to touch me or the audience. It is a metaphor for what we have to do as a nation. We have to start thinking of America as a family. We have to stop screeching at each other, stop hurting each other, and instead start caring for, sacrificing for, and sharing with each other. We have to stop continually criticizing, which is the cry of the ideologue, and instead get back to the can-do attitude that made America. We have to keep trying and risk failing in order to solve this country's problems. We cannot move forward if cynics and critics swoop down and pick apart anything that goes wrong to a point where we lose sight of what is right, decent, and uniquely good about America. In this season of our discontent, I find it heartening to look back. Remember during the 60s and 70s when people wondered how we could survive the assassinations of John, Martin, and Bobby, a war that tore us apart, riots in front of the White House, and the resignations in disgrace of a vice president and a president. Some counted us out, another once great empire in terminal decline, but we came roaring back while other empires fell instead. We will prevail in our present trials. We will come through because our founders bequeathed us a political system of genius. We will continue to flourish because our diverse American society has the strength, hardiness, and resilience of the hybrid plant we are. We will make it because we know we are blessed, and we will not throw away God's gift to us. Jefferson once wrote, "There is a debt of service due from every man to his country, proportioned to the bounties which nature and fortune have measured to him. As one who has received so much from his country, I feel that debt heavily, and I can never be entirely free of it. My responsibility, our responsibility as lucky Americans, is to try to give back to this country as much as it has given to us as we continue our American journey together.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.